Pittsburgh Section, National Council of Jewish Women, Oral History 2. Jane Berkey and Natalie Mandelblatt are interviewing Nancy Frank on Friday, November 14, 1975. Tape number 2.
Nancy, we have a few questions that are pertinent to our interview of the other day.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I'll just read them off to you, and they just require a short answer.
Yeah.
You had mentioned the quilts that your mother had been involved with selling and so forth.
Yeah.
Who actually made the quilts?
Women who lived in the country in Kentucky near Hardinsburg. I can't give you the exact location, but it was a small rural community where they raised sheep. And this was a cottage industry.
Mm-hmm. Fine. Can you give us the birth date of your brother?
Yes, well, it's February 2nd, and he was born just 3.5 years older than I am, so I was born in 10. I guess that would be 1970. Grandpa's
day. We didn't know who was older.
Do you happen to know the date of death of any of your grandparents or your parents?
Yes, I could give them to you roughly. My father died in 1914. My mother died. I'm trying to think how old the children were. I would say that around 1950, around then, I mean, I have it written down at home. My maternal grandmother, that's grandmother half, died when I was a senior in college as an undergraduate, so that would have been December 1930. And her husband died long before I was born. Mm-hmm. That was around the turn of the century, I think I told you that. I never knew him.
Mm-hmm. What were their first names?
Eva Half was my maternal grandmother. Her maiden name was Seelig, S-E-L-I-G. And my grandfather's name was Isaac.
Would you be good enough to spell Dr. DeLee's name for us?
Well, it was D E L double E, but whether, and I think it must have been a capital L. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Also, you mentioned the Smith School when you were talking about schools that were first offering Master of Social Work.
Mm-hmm.
Which?
Smith College, School of Social Work, was one of the charter schools of what was then called the American Association of Schools of Social Work, as was Carnegie. But there were a group. They came into being shortly after World War I. And the whole idea of psychiatric training in social work came about because of the impact of the shell shock veterans and the need to train people to deal with this. I've never seen this written, but this was what I was told when I was in school.
One other fact, Abe's birth date and also the date of his death.
Oh, well, his birth date was June 16th, 1908, and he died February 4th, 1959.
Natalie, take
a look. Stop for the call. Well, we were talking about the switch in occupation from lab technician to social work, and it is probably not as unusual as you might think. What the dynamic is, I really couldn't tell you, but I can think of at least two women whom I have known beside myself in social work who made the same change. One of whom was Margaret Jacob, who actually trained at this agency when she decided to switch professions and went on to become a district supervisor for the Department of Public Welfare. Extremely competent person. And the other one was the late Catherine Wallace, whom I had the privilege of working with in the ancillary services for the aged when we were in the OEO program. And it was just one of the greatest professional experiences of my lifetime. Catherine was simply a modern-day Jane Addams. That's the only way one can explain it. She just had it all. And she came to a terribly sad end. One day she just didn't show up for work, and we were very concerned about her because this was most unlike Catherine. When the two nurses in the program went out and found her dead. It was just devastating to us. So she was the other one, and I think there must be others because we used to kid about and say we ought to have a club of social workers who are ex-technicians. It's a very good background, incidentally, for a social worker because it gives you an excellent medical background.
You also look at situations differently.
More scientifically? Yeah. I don't think so. I hadn't thought about it. That's a very good question. Suppose there is a certain scientific orientation that you take, but I don't know. Never thought about that.
Let's talk about some of the history of your family in Milwaukee and then get back to
get back to the present then. Well, I just wanted to amend what I had said. I was talking with my son about having mentioned Label Rinse Cup and the real estate flim flam, and he said that he thought that story was apocryphal, although I'm sure I remember hearing it as a child. But his great aunt, who was my aunt, really the widow of my uncle, who's the only one left from that generation, was talking with Fred recently, and she said, no, she'd never heard that story. And she lives in Milwaukee, but did he know about someone who was of the same generation, who ran for Congress, and who was elected, but couldn't serve because he had failed to become an American citizen? That always been told that there was someone who was mayor of Milwaukee and had the first bathtub in Milwaukee, but this apparently is really not true. But someone did run for Congress and got elected and never served.
That's all very interesting. I love your story. Your professional life in the social work started in 1939?
Right. I took my training beginning 37 and it began in 39. And I had my first year's training at Jewish Social Service Bureau, which was the predecessor of Jewish Family and Children's Service. And my second year training, really by agreement with the two agencies, because I had a stipend from each agency, with the Pittsburgh Child Guidance Center, which was in its infancy there. It was just 5 years old when I went. And I can't remember whether there was a what we call a commitment or not, whether I was obligated to come back to Jewish Family Service in repayment for the stipend. That I really don't remember, but I do think that's a possibility because I didn't consider any other job and I came back to the agency as a caseworker. But began at the opposite end of the age continuum from where I am. I began in child placement and adoption. That was what I did for the first, whatever it was, 3.5 years that I worked.
And how did that evolve into what you're doing now?
Well, I resigned when I was pregnant with my first child. And then, as I think I mentioned last time, almost by accident, I came back to work in 1955. And at that time, there was just beginning to be some pressure within the agency and from the community to consider programs for the aged. But what direction this was going to take, the administration and the professional supervisors of the agency were beginning to contemplate whether it should take the direction of foster homes for the aged or just what was undecided. But because this was brewing and because I had, which I hadn't realized, an interest in working with older people, it just came out that way. I was in family service and I had what we call a generalized family service caseload. We still had quite a few new Americans that we were helping at that time. But by happenstance, I got a couple of aged cases and I enjoyed them. And I had a supervisor, Ralph Ensel, who was interested in them and who gave me, and I think I mentioned this last time, quite a bit of flexibility and limited goals with them. It's, you know, it would require a whole lecture on the profession and where we were professionally at that time and what kinds of goals we set for ourselves in counseling as compared with the kinds that we set now. But he was interested in this too and quite flexible and was one for me to be quite flexible. So that was that. Then I resigned after 3.5 years, I think it was. I resigned in the fall of 58, with really no thought about coming back to work for at least a couple of years. And then when Mr. Goodman called me, especially because they wanted to set up a service to agent, and he said, somebody told me that you had shown an interest in this, and I said yes. And that was how I came back, and that was how I took the direction. You know, my husband was, you call it a Hardiest or a Hardian, a great follower of Thomas Hardy's environmental fatalism, and he had a strong belief that what happens to us is really a function of being in a certain place at a certain time. And I think that's what this is.
I think that's authentic. Can you give any short comparison of the earlier goals and what has come about with them?
Well, let me think about this. I think that one of the reasons that we have been able to do what we have with older people is that we have been willing to settle for much more limited goals. I'm not sure that in family counseling cases we really try to reorganize a personality that's, if it's a function of anyone, and I'm not sure it's anyone's function, it's a psychiatric function. But certainly, they do have, as a general principle, I think, more ambitious goals in terms of modifying the family's functioning or the individual's functioning. Whereas in services to aging, you are not always, but most usually, dealing with a deteriorating situation, so that the best that you can hope for is to stabilize, retard the rate of deterioration, so that it's a very different set of values that one settles for. And also, it affects the work administratively in that in point of time and investment of service, it's very different, because a long time for a person to be in counseling and family service would be 1 to 2 years, whereas in services to aged, we take cases knowing in advance that if we're lucky, we'll keep this person as many years as either they are alive or as they, long as they can remain out of an institution, so that it results in approaching a case with much more limited goals, but also with a willingness to invest much more time and money. And that's the reason that the numbers of cases that we deal with in services to aged has snowballed. So when we began in 59, we had 7, 8, 9, 10 cases that we inherited from the other department. Now, it is most usually, if you check the statistics, the single largest department in the agency. Any one month we have the not greatly larger, but a larger proportion of active cases than any of the other departments. But this is a function of a number of things, of the willingness of this agency philosophically to invest this much professional time. I think Jane's father, when he was president of the agency, had a lot to do with this. This was an important service too, and that if we were truly going to serve the community, this was where our investment had to be. Not that we should abandon the other. And it's partly a function of larger numbers of older people in the population. And it's partly a function of methodology too, that if you want to have an aged caseload, you have to do it in a very different way. You wait for old people to come to you. And for the traditional 50-minute hour, or whatever it is that we have in many other kinds of cases, it just wouldn't have a caseload. We do 80%, 85% of our interviewing is done outside the office, either in the person's home or nursing home, or whatever. We do have some who come into us, but by and large, they're too impaired, either physically or emotionally or intellectually, to be able to do this. That answer your question?
Yes, very well.
Not
thank
very
you.
Briefly.
That wasn't necessary. You had said it was mm-hmm. Can you give us any specific idea of what you do with an average case, if there were such a thing?
Oh. This is hard to say. When I describe our work to other people in the community, I say that any problem that we deal with in services to aged derives in one way or another from the impact of the aging process. Now, this can be financial, it can be interpersonal or intrapersonal, it can be familial, which means that and certainly a lot comes from medical conditions, physical changes, and in services to aged, with older people, the borderline between the physical and the emotional or the intellectual change is very, very, very hazy. So that really, it would be hard to say what is a typical case, except that we can have a range of cases, and at one end of the continuum you might have something as relatively simple as a retired person coming in and being at loose ends because he or she is looking for some constructive activity, to something as difficult as helping young adult children or middle-aged adult children understand certain very bizarre changes in the behavior of an aging parent. Get a lot of depression, great deal of depression among older people. And then we have certain concrete services which we use to help sustain people. And sometimes the request will come in specifically for homemaking or housekeeping service or kosher meals on wheels, transportation. Now, we deal much more in the concrete service in services to aged than in the other departments. But we have a saying that the concrete is often the bridge to the relationship. I was talking with one of the workers in the department yesterday where she's presently engaged with middle-aged son and daughter-in-law and two different cases where it began really in both instances with a very concrete service, Meals on Wheels or Homemaker or something like that, where these people would probably never have come to us specifically to say, well, my husband and I are having some disagreements as to how we might deal with his mother or my mother or whatever. It just doesn't work out that way. But then once we're into it with them, then they begin to see it and we begin to see it, and then that becomes the focus of service along with them.
How is your department here constituted? Are you?
I'm the supervisor, and we have one full-time worker. And then we have beside that two half-time workers working in services to aged, and then most recently we have taken on another full-time, I guess you would call paraprofessional. She's a bachelor's degree social work graduate who came to us as what we call the transportation intake worker for our new transportation service, but really she does a lot more than just intake. She services that department, and then when she has time left over, we'll do other things for us too. So that constitutes the staff besides four homemakers and the driver of the bus.
Mm-hmm. And your average monthly caseload. How many people do you generate?
I would say actively, and that's not counting the people we take in the bus, and that's not counting the people we serve meals to, it's around 125, somewhere between 100, around that.
Who are receiving more than concrete therapy?
No. If the person is getting homemaker or housekeeping service, that's counted as a case. This is just a statistical nicety. If they're getting meals, they may or may not be a case, but most likely are not. They're just counted as recipients, not as clients. We do have some clients who get them. That accounts for a very small part of the caseload. But anyone who is getting the homemaker service is getting that in conjunction with other services that the caseworker is on. And the bus people, the passengers, they're not considered clients anymore.
And when you deal with someone as a client, how often?
How often do we see them?
Visiting weekly or?
Oh, well, this varies both with the nature of the case and with the point at which any case may be at any given time. In crisis, we may see someone every day or three times a week. On the other hand, when the case is relatively well stabilized, it might be once a month, or maybe even only every other month. And then there's some cases that are what we call inactive by plan, where we don't bother closing them. They may stabilize for a while, but we know that in 2 or 3 months something's going to come and they'll be calling us. But I suppose the average in our department would probably be every other week, with many whom we see weekly and some whom I don't need to see monthly. I know in my own caseload, which is very small, I have one woman whom I see weekly, one whom I see every other week, some whom I only see on an as-needed basis, some once a month. It varies. But in services stage one, always has to be prepared for the crisis.
I'm sure you might.
It's a very crisis-ridden kind of service. And people get heart attacks and they get strokes.
Who were some of your colleagues who you learned the most from or felt the most influence on?
Well, I've already mentioned Catherine Wallace, and it would be hard to say enough nice things about her. Catherine was actually a group worker. She was not a case worker. But there are some group workers who are so sensitive to the individual that I would trust my right hand with them in any casework situation. And she was certainly one of them.
Excuse me, which organization was she with?
Well, I'll give you a reprint which describes the program in which we work together, if you would like to have that. But and during the time when the agency had an affiliation with the Office of Economic Opportunity, we had an experimental agent service program, which has since been taken over in a somewhat different and I think diluted form by the Housing Authority, and we don't have to go into the reasons for that unless you would like to. And on an informal subcontract basis, our agency gave the casework service for this program, which was really a Kingsley House program funded by OEO, and it provided service primarily to the people in the housing facility known as Auburn Towers in East Liberty and the other in Garfield Heights in Garfield, although it was open to neighborhood older people then, which unfortunately it is not now. And this was for a period of about two and a half. And as I say, I have a a reprint of an article, which was something I did for a Jewish conference program, where the thrust of the program was about aged Jewish people being left in a frightening enclave in a changing, deteriorating neighborhood, and the kinds of services that had to be offered to them. Now, we had the opposite experience here. We did not have that. But what our experience was the opposite of having had an experience of offering service to Jewish people who had voluntarily moved into an integrated community. And this was what I described, what our experience was. So you can have that. And Catherine Walsh was the director of that project. But you were asking me about who else really influenced me. I think we had several psychiatric consultants here at the agency from whom I feel I have learned a great deal. At least I find myself quoting them more when I'm trying to teach other people. One was Alex Bujon, who was still practicing here and who's affiliated with the university. And the other was Martin Shapiro, who was affiliated also with Child Guidance and has since left the community. And the present consultant, Dr. Wodnicki, whom I got to know when he was on the staff at the Jewish Home and who is no longer on the staff there but is a... is our agency consultant, and I think I've learned a great deal from the three of them, certainly from any supervisor I've ever had at this agency. I've learned a great deal. Mr. Goodman has helped me enormously. I think that he was in large part responsible for the development of the program, but not specifically, certainly, well, specifically too, but also in the encouragement that he was given to the department.
I don't know if we have his first name.
Nathaniel Goodman.
You mentioned just now that the experience with your agency was different as far as the change in neighborhoods affecting the aged.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any reasons for that?
Well, you can read that in the paper. My explanation for it was there were several, and this is entirely unscientific. First of all, the Jewish population in Pittsburgh had not been concentrated in the way it had in some communities. There had been some in the Hill, but by and large, by the time that the whole shift and the problem of the black-white integration was with us, the Jewish people, as well as the Jewish institutions, had moved out of the Hill District. And I give the dates in the paper. The Montefiore had moved, the Irene Kaufman Center had moved, the Home for Aged had moved. This was not true in other communities where you had Jewish institutions left in a substantially non-Jewish and possibly predominantly black or Spanish neighborhood. And what did you do with the older people who were left there in an atmosphere which could and sometimes was quite a hostile and frightening atmosphere? And how did one use these institutions? Now, we did not have this because those institutions had moved up. Plus the fact that for over a period of time, the Jewish population had already dispersed and had moved from the Hill to Oakland, to East End, to Squirrel Hill, etc. So that I felt, and this was simply my own idea, I couldn't validate it scientifically, that this was the reason that we were not left with any substantial number of older Jewish people in an essentially alien environment, which was what other workers from other agencies, I know there was someone from New York, and I believe someone from Boston, and from Detroit, who reported at the same conference, and their experience was entirely different from ours. I think we were just fortunate. There were some people there who took exception to what I said, and they said, we just can't believe that they aren't there and that you're not finding them. And maybe they were right, but we now, in our whole caseload, have one case still in that area. We had had more in 1959, but gradually these people either died or went into the home, or we moved them to other neighborhoods. One woman with whom I worked, the problem was, helping to